Okay, so we're here at the Earth at Risk Conference in San Francisco. I'm sitting down with Derek Jensen, who is an author and has been deeply involved in the struggle that the struggle of sanity, maybe if you will. And we're sitting down here today to ask him about a few things. One of which is this event's goal is to help craft a game-changing response to address the converging crises that we face today. So, Derek, in your eyes, what do those crises look like, and what do you think? Or what should the response look like?
Well, really simply, the crisis is this culture is killing the planet. And it's been doing so ever since its beginning. And, you know, I'm going to talk about this later tonight, that when people think of Iraq as the first thing they think of, cedar forest so thick that sunlight never touches the ground. And that's what it was prior to the beginnings of this culture.
Yep.
Near East was heavily forested, North Africa, Greece, Italy. And this culture has been systematically destroying the planet for 6,000 years. And that's to have a culture that is based on infinite growth, which is what capitalism is, or before that, just empire, is not going to end well on a finite planet. And so the crises are... this culture commits genocide against indigenous peoples as people of the land, and it destroys the land. This place where we are right now, San Francisco, was forested, and the parts that weren't forested were shoulder-high grass. And there were so many sea lions that people thought that the entire water was paved with sea lions. There were, quote, troops, end quote, of grizzly bears. And there would be beached whales, and we'll routinely see beached whales. There's whales. Some person said that a whale would come up about every 30 seconds beside the boat. And, of course, if you have a lot of whales are dying. They go on shore where there would be, once again, troops of grizzly bears. It's a place that's incredibly fecund.
And this was just a couple hundred years ago.
Just a couple hundred years ago. And so I don't understand why. So there's one part of the crisis is physical. Another part of the crisis is psychological and social, which is I don't understand how that doesn't frighten most people, and I don't understand how most people don't see that pattern.
Right.
I find it absolutely extraordinary. You know, I've written 20-some books about it, and I still don't get it. You know, it doesn't make any sense to me. Right. Why would you – like I saw this headline the other day that is many states face a choice between – drinking water and fracking. And this was posed as a, quote, dilemma. And they said scientists' response to this dilemma are mixed. It's like, okay, we're talking about drinking water. This is not even some beautiful thing like monarch butterflies. This is drinking water. And no matter how much I write about it, I don't understand how anybody could be stupid enough to poison your own drinking water. Doesn't make a lot of sense to me.
Yeah, I mean, it seems as though the drinking water is of course, of utmost importance. It seems as though we're poisoning the planet in profound ways. It's not just the drinking water. It's the air, it's the oceans, it's the soil, it's absolutely everything. As far as a response, if this conference here is trying to draft a response, you know, and I think obviously a response can look like many different things. But in your eyes, what does that response look like? How urgent, you know, is the situation? And you know, is it going to need to be all hands on deck? Is it people making different decisions, different choices? It seems as though the governments of the world are not going to be of any help. So does it boil down to the people?
Well, the fundamental purpose of government is to facilitate commerce. And I mean, sure, I get in trouble with anarchists when I say that I think that there actually should be laws against rape, because they don't believe there should be any laws, many of them. But that, I mean, of course there should be strictures, laws, somehow enforcement of there should not be rape, and when someone does rape, that there should be prohibitions against it, and there should be other behaviors that are prohibited. That said, once again, the primary function of government is to serve commerce. And so, no, they're not going to be on our side. They're never going to be on the side of the living. They're going to be on the side of commerce. Mm-hmm. And even when I was a very, very young activist, I recognized the insanity. It's like it really struck me when they say we need to balance the needs of the economy versus the environment. And that's an acknowledgement on their part that the economy is in opposition to the environment. Mm-hmm. And who would have a crazy system where you're actually having an economy that destroys the basis of life? That's just, that's completely nuts. It's psychopathic, which is what I'm going to talk about tonight. And that's, so I forgot the rest of the question because I was focusing just on the government part.
Do you want to ask them, you want to come in here?
What do I want to do?
There needs to be a response. Like, we need to respond. The people of the planet need to respond.
So the first thing, we need to give up. I'm not saying that we shouldn't use the government whenever we can, because I believe I am completely pragmatic in that what I care about is the continued existence of salmon or monarch butterflies, or I want there to be less dioxin in every mother's, I want there to be no dioxin in every mother's breast milk. And I don't care how that happens. It can happen through regulation. It can happen through prohibition. It can happen through the entire collapse of the economic system. I don't care. I just want there to be more salmon and more migratory songbirds, et cetera. And so I think one of the things that we need to do is to figure out what we want. I mean, that's one of my, I've expressed this to Bill McKibben, one of my concerns about him. Yes, he raised a lot of awareness about global warming. But somewhere along the way, environmentalism stopped being about protecting the earth and became about, quote, sustainability, end quote, which is about continuing this culture that's killing the planet. Mm-hmm. And that's not where our loyalty needs to be. So one of the things I want to emerge from this conference is for the people in attendance and then the people they know and the people they know to be able to shift our allegiance away from the economic system, away from what Lewis Mumford called the machine, and toward the land and toward the other victims of this culture. Tomorrow we're going to have panels on stopping pornography, stopping prostitution. So we want, when we're talking about this, and we had a very strong indigenous speakers earlier today. So when I talk about protecting the natural world, I'm not just talking about that. I'm talking about making your allegiance absolute with the victims of this culture. And when you switch your allegiance, and you have to switch your identity too. So many indigenous people have said to me that the first and most important thing that we have to do is to decolonize our hearts and minds. And one of the things that means to me is make it so your identification is not with the system. So I have, I mean, it's kind of a joke, but a friend of mine called me up a few years ago and said, how much longer do you think we're going to be in Iraq? And I said, oh my God, we're in Iraq, either we're Northern California. And the point is that we identify even on that level,
right?
Just that superficial level. My mom, it's so funny. My mom, this is like a month ago, she was saying, oh my God, it's so terrible that we torture. I was like, oh mom, you torture? That's horrible. And she's like, I'm 82 years old, don't do this to me. And the point is that, you know, we use the we. And a great example of that is George Monbiot wrote this essay right after Fukushima, in which he said that the reason that we need to have nuclear power is because how else are we going to get the electricity that we need to run our factories?
Right.
I'm going to change a couple words and see how that sounds. How else are the capitalists going to get the electricity that they need to run their factories?
Right.
Makes all the difference in the world. So one of the things I want from this is for people to begin to identify with and to try to protect the real world.
Yep.
And then after that, what you do is up to you, and I don't mean that in a cop-out way. What I mean by that is I don't know your gifts, so I can't tell you what to do. It'd be ridiculous for me to say to you, well, what you need to do is go rehabilitate a salmon stream.
Sure.
You know, there's, like, I've got a friend, Charlotte Watson, who used to run a battered women's program in the state of New York. She does great, great work attempting. She asks every man she sees, what will it take for men to stop beating on women? She's relentless. And it would be ridiculous for me to say, you need to stop doing that and protect salmon. It's like, what the hell?
Right.
And likewise, I was working with this wetland specialist a few years ago. And at one time we were out, he was digging up some soil, and he'd rub it between his fingertips, and he would compare the color of the soil to a chart. if it's a certain color, then he knows it's wetlands and it has higher level protection. As we're doing this, I say, so do you get off on doing this? He said, oh, yeah, this is my second favorite thing to do after playing with my dogs. And I said, man, I would hate this. I wouldn't like doing it. On the other hand, I completely get off on trying to figure out the relationship between perceived entitlement, exploitation, and atrocity. You know, I've condemned myself to a life of homework. And that's what I get off on. And my dear friend over there, Stephanie, she's an organizer. And this doesn't seem like it here, but I am a profound introvert. And so when I'm here, I can talk to people. But normally, it's like, and people say, Derek, you should be an organizer. It's like, I don't want to talk to anybody. Are you kidding? Sure. That scares me. On the other hand, she talks to people all the time. Right. She goes up and just talks to people,
right.
Talks to strangers.
Right. So you're saying basically that everybody has a place, that if we can find what makes us feel good, that it helps solve the problem, go for it. Put all your energies in that direction.
And, you know, you used a really important phrase. You said all hands on deck. And where does that come from? That's a military phrase from the Navy. You're an emergency, yep. So you need all hands on deck. And you don't have one person can't run and load the torpedo tubes and then run upstairs and man the anti-aircraft
right.
weapons and then run up and steer the boat, you know.
Right.
We need people to do. It's like I've got a friend, Sharon Duggan, who is this fabulous attorney who has argued against timber companies all the way to the state Supreme Court in California. And I was working with her one time on this case. She was actually helping me with something. And in exchange for her helping me with that, I had to do some of the basic legal writing. You know, I do my writing, but, oh my God, it was the same deal. I had to say to her, you like doing this? You like writing this stuff? I said, oh, yeah, I love it. It would drive me nuts. But she's really good at it.
Yep.
And so, you know, we need all hands on deck, and we need people to, you know, okay, so the some people are, you know, in front of the anti-aircraft guns or behind the anti-aircraft guns, I guess. And then, you know, somebody else is having to bring them the ammunition. And somebody else, once it's over, somebody else has to give them the food. And somebody else is down in the infirmary to take care of the people who are wounded. We need everything. We need it all. Mm-hmm. I sometimes get pegged as the violence guy.
Yeah.
And I find that really both unfair and it's inaccurate. I don't care if it's unfair. It's inaccurate. Sometimes I feel like I should have just written, you know, 20,000 pages of writing and all of them are blank and one page in the middle that says sometimes it's okay to fight back.
Right.
Because that's all they notice.
Right.
But the truth is I should be known as the everything guy because I fully believe in people working within the system. I believe in people who don't work within the system. I believe in people who file lawsuits, file timber sales.
Yep.
I believe in people who do physical labor of helping to physically rehabilitate streams.
Yep.
It's like people doing this, you know, people publishing the books that have to do with this.
Mm-hmm.
We need it all, and we desperately need it all. The big distinction is not between those who believe that we need militant resistance and those who don't believe we need militant resistance. The big distinction is between those who do something and those who do nothing.
Right.
You know, the thing that breaks my heart, this is very well attended. You know, there's, what, 500-600 people in there?
Sure.
But it's a hell of a lot less than at the next 49ers game.
Right.
And
right.
One of the things I've said for years that breaks my heart is that there are more people who care about the Detroit Tigers than who care about real Tigers. And that's part of the problem that we
right.
face.
Yeah.
And we can't, you know, Jeanette Armstrong is one of the people here, and she's one of my heroes. And years ago, there was one activist wrote an essay attacking another activist. And I asked her what she thought about that. And she said, well, if he didn't like it, he should have written his own damn book. And I really like that because I think if you don't like what other people are doing, great, do a better job. It's really simple. The reason I write my stuff is because, well, I wanted to be a writer, but I didn't know what to write. And then I saw a huge hole in discourse. And the hole was there weren't any really impassioned, militant environmental books.
Mm.
You have African Americans who are writing some pretty militant and angry work, and you've got some women writing some militant and angry work. Andrea Dworkin comes to mind. And environmentalism, as soon as you get to that, it's all like fluffy bunnies and happy days.
Right.
And so instead of me just sitting around complaining all day that there's this hole in discourse, it's like, okay, I got a job to do. And people write to me all the time and they'll say, it's so funny. They'll say, gosh, Derek, here's a book I think you should write. And they'll tell me about all this thing that they think is so important. I always say the same thing back to them, which is, wow, you've got a lot of energy about that. Why don't you write that book?
Right.
Go for it.
Right.
Great. So there needs to be a campaign about XYZ. Great. Nobody's doing it.
You got something to do. Yeah.
Yeah.
What about the youth of America? I mean, I think our public school system is woefully inadequate, and it seems as though the majority of children these days, although it's shifting a little bit, but it seems as though that they're really not aware of the grave situation that we're in. But it seems as though also that we really need to rely on the youth because they're the next generation that could really affect this change into a more sustainable direction, if it's even possible. What would you say to, if you had an opportunity to speak to the youth of America, what would you tell them to give them, and we don't necessarily like to use the word hope, but I think in this instance it may be necessary. What would you say to the youth of America?
I guess the most important thing is that never believe anything you read and rarely believe anything you think. And think for yourself. And I actually think that schools are quite effective because I think one of the fundamental purposes of school is to turn us into good workers and to break us of the dreadful habit of critical thinking.
Right.
And, you know, when I was in high school, I don't know if you thought about this a lot, but I thought about this all the time. It's like, why does school take so long? And, you know, they could have actually taught you the material in 3 or 4 years. I mean, once you learn addition, subtraction, et cetera, you don't really learn anything till algebra. And, you know, I learned all that just watching baseball, frankly. You know, ERA, you have to do addition, subtraction, division. And I thought, when I was in high school, I thought that the purpose was to break you of the habit of daydreaming because I sat in the back of class all day long daydreaming, and you can only win the World Series so many times. And I got bored of daydreaming. And I finally realized that the reason that school takes so long is because children don't give up their wills easily. And it takes a long time for them to break the wills of children sufficiently to prepare them for painful employment.
Mm.
And for the children who are especially slow, there's college. And for the exceedingly obstinate child, there's graduate school.
Mm.
And so I think on that level, schools are successful. Having said that, I also want to say that even within this wretched so-called education system. See, education, the thing is, I don't have a problem with education because education comes from the edukera, which means to lead forth or draw out, and was originally a Greek midwife's term meaning to be present at the birth of. And I have had Mrs. Meyerly, my 8th grade, I wouldn't be a writer if it weren't for Mrs. Meyerly, my 8th grade English teacher. Even within the context of this dreadful system, I think that there are teachers who have this sacred task of being present at the birth of children, at the birth of human beings, young human beings. And, you know, I can count 3 or 4 teachers I ever had who saved my life. And so, yeah, children, what I would say to them is don't believe anything anybody says. Think for yourself and figure out what's going on. And I would also want to say to teachers that you have a sacred task. You've been given these beautiful young minds, and you have a choice when you work with them as to where you're going to lead them, because children are sponges. That's their job, is to take in. And what they're taking in so often is television, the internet, just very, very scary things. And here's another thing I want to say to parents and to children. Go outside. One reason that I love the natural world is because every day, all day when I was a kid, all through the summer, I would be out in the irrigation ditch, you know, playing with crawdads. The crawdads probably did not appreciate me playing with them, but, you know, and listening to meadowlarks and catching grasshoppers to feed the toads and all sorts of things. And I read something several years ago that at this point the average child spends 15 minutes a day outside. And how do you expect to have a love of nature if you don't know it? So what Jeanette was saying about you need to know your place to love it.
Right.
And I mean, how we've now spent, 20 minutes talking? It's like, and I don't know you. I mean, it takes a long time to know somebody. And it's the same for a non-human. It takes a long time to know and appreciate the land where you live. So that's something I would say to teachers and to parents is get your kids outside.
Yep.
And, you know, I wrote a book against zoos, and one of the things that I was saying about zoos is zoos teach us many terrible lessons. For one thing, they teach us that if you can put a wolverine in a concrete cage and it's still a wolverine. It's teaching us that a wolverine is separable from its habitat, which is very terrible, and it's also terrible about humans, that humans here, it's presuming humans are still humans. But the other thing it teaches us is that you can mistreat the natural world and still see a bear.
Right.
But what the real lesson should be is, no, you don't see any bears because we don't treat them well. And if we treat them better, honestly, I see bears at home every single day. And the reason is because my mom and I treat them well. You know, it's if you treat them well. Okay, so here's the thing, is even in the city, there is still nature. I can still hear seagulls. I can still, and there's no reason because they're, why is a cheetah in San Francisco more special than a seagull? I mean, a cheetah shouldn't be here. A seagull should. And no matter where you go, even if you're in a parking lot, ants are still there. There's still bumblebees there, maybe. There's still weeds that are pushing up through the concrete, plants that are pushing up through the concrete. And so you should start by loving those. They're here.
Yeah.
And so what I would say to, oh, another thing I would say to children, I think this is really important. I am so sorry because my generation is killing the planet and we are not solving the problems. And what we're doing is we're passing them on to you, and that is entirely unacceptable.
Yeah, entirely unacceptable. In fact,
so I don't want to push it off on the children. That's the thing, is I don't want to tell the children anything. Children, it's not their fucking responsibility, excuse me. It's not their responsibility. Children, your job as a child is to play. Your job as a child is not to save the planet. So, no, I don't actually, I mean, it's a great question, and my anger is not at you for asking the question. My anger is at the reality of the situation. We shouldn't be having to say anything to children except
go play.
Go play. And, oh, you want to watch? Well, I embroider this, you know, then that's what children are supposed to do.
Imagine and dream.
That's your job. I hate the word job. That's your role. That's your lot in life is to play.
Yeah.
And
we're taking that opportunity away from them, in essence, or the opportunity has been already taken away to a greater extent.
Yeah, and it's continuing to be. It is our job. It is our role to fix things. You know, I've heard people say, I'm going to have a kid because then I'm going to turn my kid into the kick-ass activist that I never was. It's like, no. Right. Why don't you be the kick-ass activist that your kid would have been? You know, it's like, don't push off the responsibility. We shouldn't push off any responsibility. It is incredibly irresponsible of us to expect anything from them.
Yep. I've heard you say on a few occasions in the videos that I've watched of the various discussions or readings that you've done in the past, and you talk about this threshold of action, and I think you say something like, you know, when 90% of all the fish in the ocean are gone, is that enough for you or as an individual to stand up and fight back? Can you elaborate a little bit more on that philosophy, because it really I think it's powerful.
Well, interestingly enough, since I'm in San Francisco, I'll say this, that I got that metaphor from the book And the Band Plays On, or that image, because there's a line in there where they're talking about the early AIDS crisis, where some of the AIDS activists were confronting the city council saying, how many deaths will it take before you call this an epidemic? Will it take 100? 150? It's like, we don't care. You just give us a number, because right now you're just blowing it off. And what this really, really moved me when I read that book back in the early 90s. And that's the thing, is victims of abuse are really good at creating moving boundaries. You know what? I knew this woman, who, dear friend of mine, who basically, at first it's, well, you can hit me, but don't sexually abuse me. Then it was, well, you can hit me and you can sexually abuse me, but don't hit me in the face. And as soon as something happens, you move the goal line back. You move the line back so you don't have to do anything. And you know, actually, I'll tell you this, that I, in my own personal life, having been raised in an abusive situation, I have trouble with that too. So for myself, I've had to adopt in my personal life a one-strike-you're-out policy for abusive behavior. People can mess up. You know, we all mess up and say stupid things. That's not what I'm talking about. But if somebody's mean, I have to have a one-strike-you're-out policy because I can really easily rationalize it. So by 2 days later, I'm like, it wasn't that bad. And then I'm right back in. I can keep doing that forever. So this is something I've not only just saying outside, but it's also true internally. And then if you look at it the other way, it's like, at what point do you recognize, I'm going to say this tonight, but at what point do you recognize that it's not an anomaly? You know, 98% of the native forests are gone in the world. 98% of the wetlands. 99% of the prairies. You know, at what point are you actually going to recognize this as a problem? And, you know, we can say the same thing for carbon. You know, it's like, well, 315 is what it was pre-industrialization, and then McKibben wants 350, and it's going to 400. And this is actually something I would like to say to Bill McKibben. I've said this publicly many times. It's like, you keep working within the system. Give me a number at which you would say, well, it's the whole system that has to go. I don't care what the number is. Probably get 410, 420, 430. Because at some point, we have to see the pattern. And so that's something. This guy came up to me after a talk years ago, and he said, you know, a friend of mine says that 90% of large fish in the ocean being gone is not enough threshold to actually fight back against the system. I said, okay, great. Is it 91%? I said, no. 92. I just started counting up. I got to 99. He still didn't say anything. I got to 100%. And he said, no, I don't think my friend. It's like, what are we even talking about then? What you just said is there is no threshold. What you're saying is it could never get bad enough that you think we should fight back, in which case I'm not interested in talking with you. Because there's no point. You're not dealing with reality. So I think what we need to do...
How common do you think that train of thought is in our culture and society today?
Oh, for God's sake. I used to do this thing where when I would start my talk, I would hold up a bottle of water, and I would say, this is how I know we will not have a revolution, because if people will pay for water bottled in plastic, they will suffer any indignity. There's... You know, like it's like the whole big privacy debate over, you know, I remember the first time I walked into a store back in the 80s when they said you have to put your backpack at the counter. I remember I got really upset because, like, you don't trust me enough. I'm supposed to trust you not to rip me off. And nowadays, there is not a store around where there's not surveillance cameras on you. It's like this is the way a lot of this stuff happens. Remember there used to be a debate about whether there should be GMOs, and then all of a sudden the debate's gone and the debate is about whether we get to have labels on them. I mean, this happens with all sorts of things where here's what I'm getting at, is there's this phrase, declining baselines. And what this means is that you become increasingly inured to worsening conditions, and that's the new baseline. So in the 1930s, there were people who freaked out at Social Security numbers because this is a number that will follow you cradle to grave. Okay, so then you get a number. Okay, what next? You know, it gets to the point where, you know, all the computers are attached to each other so that if you get, you know, if you speed in Crescent City, California, they're going to know it in Nashville, Tennessee. And the... increasing, I mean, that's a great example of, you just get people used to something,
right,
and then they'll put up with it, and then the next generation puts up with something worse.
Right.
And that, here's a better example, is I was shocked when I saw the movie Clockwork Orange in the 70s. It was horrible. It's a horrible movie anyway.
Sure.
But I actually saw a little bit of it maybe 3 or 4 years ago. Oh my God, it is so tame compared to, so that's what I mean by...
Right. The slow creep.
That happens on every level. Even 15 years ago where I lived, there were these tiny blue butterflies who were everywhere. They're gone.
Right.
And so what is your threshold for resistance? Because it's so easy to sneak up on you until there's nothing left.
Yep.
My great-grandmother lived in the prairies of Nebraska, and she would, when she was a little girl, she would get scared every time it would have a lightning storm because she was afraid the thunder would spook the bison and the bison would trample on their house. How many people in Nebraska are afraid at this point that bison are going to trample their house? This was an everyday...
Sure.
I mean, she's 4 years old, so she was like not... It didn't ever happen, but there were so many bison that she was scared of that.
Right.
And, you know, it's... Every 15 minutes in California 200 years ago, you would see a grizzly bear near a river.
Right.
There's none now except on flags and zoos.
Yep.
So... That's what I'm trying to get at with that. Give yourself a numbers, because it's so easy to just let things get a little bit worse and a little bit worse and a little bit worse until there's nothing left.
Yeah. So you're saying that there needs to be individual responses. Each of us as individuals need to craft an effective response to the predicament and the perilous situation that we're in. You've done it through the writing of your books and coming to events like that. We've created this nonprofit media organization trying to get the message out in the world so people can start making informed decisions and start behaving differently. Although I interviewed Guy McPherson earlier, and he paints, obviously, a horrible picture for our future, but suggests ultimately that love is a very important component to our lives, and that if we can focus on love, that is a key towards advancing in a direction that is better in many different ways. What are your thoughts about love, and how does that fit into the equation, and how effective of a tool could it be moving forward?
Well, I think a couple of things. One is we need to remember that love is a verb,
yes,
and that it implies action.
Yes.
And one of the things that I've been saying for years is that there's a phrase that's been used about the murder of the ocean. There's this one scientist who's saying that the oceans are being, quote, reorganized. And I find that terribly dismissive. And if someone were killing the members of your family, would you say that your family's being reorganized? It's like, we're so distant about all this.
Right.
And so I think the problem, quite honestly, is that most people don't love the earth. And I don't even know that they love themselves.
Right.
It's, you know, a joke I used to tell years ago is that, I'll leave that off, that I don't think we love ourselves, because if we loved ourselves, mm-hmm, would we allow our bodies to be poisoned with dioxin?
Mm-hmm.
If you think about this, would you allow, do you have kids?
No.
Okay. Do you have a relationship or anything? Okay. So if I were to have a little vial of, poison, would you object if I injected her with it?
Sure.
But what about if my name is Conoco and I'm just putting it all across the landscape and it ends up in her body anyway?
Right.
Then all of a sudden, you know, we don't. So I have a hard time. I mean, yes, I think that love is absolutely at the core, and the problem is that we love the wrong things in this culture,
mm-hmm,
and what we think we love is not what we love.
Right.
It's like, it's an addiction.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a line I'm going to say tonight is after Fukushima, this one Japanese energy minister said, we can't imagine living without electricity. And that's really extraordinary for a bunch of reasons. One of them is that humans, of course, lived without electricity for a long time, and a lot of humans do now. But the other reason it's extraordinary is, when was the last time you heard anybody in the media say they can't imagine living without polar bears?
Right.
Or they can't imagine living without monarch butterflies or drinking water?
Right.
And that's what we need to say.
Right.
And we need to... I was talking to my mom about this the other day. We hate the politics so much, both of us. And they're so horrible. We both said, if we didn't live on this land, she and I live on opposite ends of the same land. And we say, if we didn't live on this land, we would leave the country. And we both love that land so much. People have said to me, some people were saying, oh my gosh, they're going to have to leave all of California because of Fukushima or whatever. And are you going to leave? And I said, the trees can't leave. I'm not going to leave them. I'm not going to leave them.
Right.
And so I think I think love is absolutely crucial. I think you have to love your non-human neighbors. You have to love yourself. You have to love yourself enough to not put up with the world being murdered.
Yep.
I mean, all this stuff in the culture is based on hatred of the body, and it's based on hatred of the self, and love is the answer to that. But I just want to be really clear that when we talk about love, we're not talking about some sort of namby-pamby love that means that we're supposed to turn the other cheek. I think that's incredibly harmful. Mm-hmm. When I think about love, I think about this mother grizzly bear who had to shut down a train line because a train hit her cub. And she wouldn't stop charging trains. And that's what love means. And for me, love means saying, you know, loving a forest means saying, not one more twig. And that gets back to that whole question of what's your threshold, you know? I think love. And there's also a great line by R.D. Lang that I was going to say tonight, but I had to cut it because I was way over. And there's this great bit about how love and violence, properly speaking, are opposites. Love lets the other be, but with affection and concern. Violence is attempts to constrain, but with indifference to the other's fate or something like that. And he says, we are destroying ourselves by violence masquerading as love. Mm-hmm. And I think that is so true. And think about that with abusive relationships. You know, I wouldn't hit you if I didn't love you so much, you know? Right. If I didn't love you so much, you know, that's why I'm so jealous. You know, it's all these things. So the whole notion of love, we have to deconstruct this culture's notion of love, too, because love has been pornographed. Love has been turned into a control thing, mm-hmm. and love has been turned into possession. And not just recently. This is what, I mean, in the Bible, you know, God is a jealous God, and thou shalt have, right. You know, that goes all the way back. It's really central to... This bizarre notion of love is central to patriarchy. And so we need to deconstruct and talk about what we want love to mean and what love actually does mean in this culture.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I don't have any other further questions. Is there anything else that you would like to add? Or?
No, I think your question has been fabulous.
Okay. Well, I very much appreciate you sitting down with us. Thank you for hosting the conference, and we look forward to seeing you out on the road again.
Oh, thank you. Do you want me to send anybody else out to you if you...
Talk to Chris Hedges. I'm going to interview Chris. I already interviewed.